Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, September 18th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. Well, first let's have a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it will be mostly sunny. The wind from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 82 and a low of 62. Tomorrow, Sunday, it'll be breezy, sunny. High of 88, a low of 66. On Monday, there's a chance of storms. A high of 89, a low of 61. On Tuesday, another chance of storms with a high of 75 and a low of 52. The normal high for this day is 76. The normal low is 53. The record high was 94 in 1972. The record low was 32 in 1929. The sun will set tonight at 7:11. It will rise tomorrow at 6:51. Today we have a little weather story. This one from meteorologist Kaylee Plutchel. What is a cold front? We've been tracking multiple cold fronts over the past week. So what exactly is a cold front? A front in general is a boundary between two different air masses that have different temperatures and humidity levels. A cold front is where cold air is replacing warmer air at the surface. It can cause a drastic change in the weather and move quite fast. As a cold front moves in, the cold, dense air pushes under the lighter, warm air. This lifting warmer air causes thunderstorms and stormy clouds to form ahead of the front. Winds will start to gust as the cold front is pushing through and can cause a sudden drop in temperature. And that little weather story, again, is from meteorologist Kaylee Plutchel. And now let's turn to the first story. This from the front page of today's Gazette. Let's see what we have here. Lindmarg forgoes homecoming court for inclusivity. Students instead recognized for perseverance, respect, integrity, determination, and empathy. And this story is by Grace King of the Gazette. A king and queen will not be crowned at Lindmar High School's homecoming this year or in the future, as a school pivots to a more inclusive way of recognizing seniors. While students still celebrate homecoming this year by dressing up all week for theme days, having a parade, and holding a dance today, the tradition of the homecoming court is no more. Instead, students are starting a new tradition. Lindmar seniors being recognized for exemplifying the characteristics of perseverance, respect, integrity, determination, and empathy, or pride. The change, which began last spring after homecoming festivities were canceled because of the pandemic, was made by district officials with input from students. Students came up with the name, riffing on the school's mascot, a lion. On May 1st, 24 students were recognized for their perseverance, respect, integrity, determination, and empathy. The honors next will be given in spring 2022. Students are nominated for the pride recognition by their peers. Juniors and seniors at Lindmar will have the opportunity each year to write a few sentences about their fellow students and how they embody those characteristics. A committee of students and staff then reads through the nominations and chooses the top contenders. Any number of students may be chosen for the honor. Quote, it makes you feel so much better about those people who win because you know they totally deserved it, said Sophia Good, Lindmar senior and student council president. It's not as much of a popularity contest. Last year, Good was hesitant about the loss of having a homecoming court. She said, quote, everyone wants the chance to be homecoming queen. But as she celebrates homecoming this year, Without a homecoming court, she said, it feels more inclusive. Pride of Linmar is a gender-neutral option to homecoming court. Students who don't identify as male or female are transgender, lesbian, or gay may be recognized for the honor. Pivoting from a homecoming court to the Pride of Linmar has been in the works for several years, said Linmar principal Jeff Gustafson. Gustafson agreed that the practice is more inclusive and represents students who have done some incredible things to stand out as leaders. Students recognized last year are empathetic and selfless, Gustafson said. He said, quote, I want every student to feel a part of Linmar High School. Carla Blakely, a teacher who is the Student Council sponsor, read through the nominations last year. She said, quote, the responses we got last spring made me, and I think everyone who read them, incredibly proud of those students and what our school is doing. Principal Gustafson said he is concerned about the potential spread of COVID-19 during the homecoming dance. He said, quote, we want people to use their own judgment, and we're going to try to make it as safe an event as possible. The average number of students attending homecoming dances in the past has been over 1,300, he said. Good, the student council president, also is concerned about a rise in cases after the dance. She is vaccinated and plans on wearing a mask during the dance. All right, let's find another story here. All right, here is a story also from the front page. Regents eye more deals with private sector. And the story is by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. Just as the Board of Regents' latest five-year strategy plans nears its end, higher education across the nation, as in Iowa, finds itself experiencing widespread disruption and is primed for a fresh start. Quote, this is time to say we've gotten really hit. We've got to make changes, University of North Carolina Chapel Hill professor and higher education consultant Paul N. Friga told Iowa's nine volunteer regents during a five-hour gathering Friday aimed at developing a 2022-27 strategic plan. He said, quote, make big changes while you can. Then you come out on the upside with new investments, new programs, new energy, and you can capture a bigger share and be much better prepared for the future. Among the disruptions, Regents said, they'll need to address in their new five-year plan are enrollment declines, decreased state investment, increased reliance on digital learning, surging demand for mental health services, demographic shifts, and the need for programmatic efficiencies. Quote, I think we have to begin to look at higher education different with regard to revenue streams because I don't see state funding ever coming back to the level it was in previous years, Regent Jim Lindenmayer said, and I don't think we can continue to depend on tuition like we are, period. I think we have to start looking at private resources. He noted that private has always been a dirty word in public higher education. But I think if we're going to adequately fund them, we're going to have to look at those kinds of streams somehow, he said. University collaborations with private entities like the $1.165 billion utilities partnership with the University of Iowa recently entered can't entirely replace state appropriations and tuition revenue, which must remain part of the funding formula, Regent David Barker said. Barker said, quote, tuition increases will have to be part of the mix. If appropriations aren't up and our costs are going up, tuition is going to have to increase. But with access and affordability still a top priority, the board's next strategic plan could allow revenue sources to be a little more dynamic, Board of Regents Executive Director Mark Brown said. But not stepping away from state support or moderate tuition increases. Highlighting the University of Iowa's incredibly successful public-private partnership for the operation of its utilities, which allowed the University of Iowa to get upfront money for creating an educational endowment, Brown asked Regents whether they should promote the concept more explicitly in the strategic plan. Noting that term can apply broadly, not just to operational collaboration, but to research and industry collaboration, Regent Nancy Dunkel said, quote, if you put that in our strategic plan, it gives the green light to the universities to do even more. It would show the board is encouraging appropriate and supervised public-private partnerships that promote research, financial, and operational collaboration, Board President Mike Richard said. Nonetheless, Dunkel urged care. Quote, we don't want the biggest pot of money to be influencing education, she said. So that has to be kind of weighed out, appropriately monitored, and transparent. Citing a recent survey, the board disseminated to its own members and also to some students, faculty, staff, and administrators, lawmakers, and others asked about the board's mission and priorities. Brown noted the need for more transparency or communications. Quote, is that something that we need to step up in the next strategic plan? He asked. Make more communication, provide more material, more opportunity for engagement, not only with legislators, but with public and with faculty, staff, and students. The board earned the lowest marks for appropriately engaging stakeholders, according to the survey, which found only half of respondents agreed the board did so. Looking specifically at how the board engages external stakeholders, like legislators and the governor, just half of the lawmakers or state employees responding said Regents did so appropriately. Highlighting higher education trends, the board will need to consider in crafting the strategic plan. Consultant Friga warned that enrollment is declining, more campuses are freezing tuition or slowing the increases, and many have overbuilt facilities. Quote, most higher ed has overinvested in physical infrastructure, overinvested in enrollments, he said. We've got an oversupply. We have millions and millions of excess capacity already built in. Friga warned the Regents will need to make sometimes difficult decisions to weather the coming storm. He urged the board to diversify its universities, to make them stand apart and expand their pool of students prospects into the adult and working population. He said, quote, I would advise you to get into the associate degree business. He said of Iowa's four-year campuses that offer bachelor, master's, and doctoral degrees, and go after the adult population as a serious effort. Friga advised urging elimination of redundant services and programs. He said, quote, we have a lot of transactional people on our campuses and lots of new technologies will allow you to eliminate those kinds of positions, he said. So you've got to be ruthless with this. Academic program reviews will require even more courage. Quote, let's say 10% are going to be discontinued, he said. And you're going to use criteria such as enrollments, spend per student, direct and indirect costs, market demand, encouraging the regions and the universities to launch new innovative programs too. Friga told them to be aggressive about it. And by the quote, and by the way, they're going to be genuinely unhappy about this, he said. Because again, no faculty want their program to be eliminated. But some of them should be eliminated. It's just we have a hard time saying no to programs once they get started. The regents and staff next will draft a new strategic plan emphasizing its public service, civic responsibility, and academic and research missions in hopes of bringing something for public consideration in November. Now I'll turn to the Iowa Today page of the Gazette for this story. Fatal police shooting of Jones County man with knife ruled justified. Man charged at officers with a knife after at one point running away. And this story is by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. The Iowa Attorney General's office has determined the August 31st fatal shooting of a Jones County man by police was justified because the man would not put down a knife and charged at officers. But the family of Jeremy Berg, 45, say the knife was a pocket knife and the officer should have just let Berg run away as he tried to do at one point. Quote, I don't know why they just didn't let him go, said Berg's mother, Margie Fensterman of Colesburg. He must have lunged with the pocket knife, and when one officer opened fire, they all did. Berg died of multiple gunshot wounds inflicted by officers during the standoff at his grandparents' farm near Martell. The professional tree trimmer suffered from depression and methamphetamine addiction, and Fensterman told the Gazette on September 2nd she thought it was possible he wanted officers to kill him. The Attorney General's office released a report Friday afternoon detailing what happened during the standoff that led to Berg's death. Quote, officers in this situation were confronted with a person who was behaving in a threatening manner and was armed with a knife that could have caused serious injury or death to any person, including officers. Assistant Attorney General Douglas Hammer and wrote, quote, the officers made repeated efforts de-escalate situations by giving multiple commands to drop the knife and comply with the officers. In addition, the officers deployed less lethal options on five separate occasions. A taser was deployed 3 times, and a less lethal shotgun with beanbags was fired 2x. But they were unable to subdue Berg or get him to drop the knife. If Berg would have dropped the knife, officers wouldn't have had to use lethal force, Hammerin wrote. Quote, because of Berg's actions in quickly advancing toward the officers with a knife raised in his hand, they had no other reasonable choice but to shoot Berg, he wrote. The shooting happened after officers were called to the scene of a fire in an outbuilding at the farm of Jerry and LaVon Pearson, Berg's maternal grandparents. Berg had been working on a car in the machine shop when the fire started, Fensterman said. When the Pearsons saw the flames, the family called 911. LaVon Pearson tried to get Berg to come out of the shop, and it filled with smoke. But he refused to leave, Fensterman said, September 2nd. Quote, he figured he was at fault and was going to die in there, she wrote. She said, Berg's cousin broke a window and pulled Berg from the building, Fensterman said. Her son's arms were blackened by the flames and the skin was falling off, she said. He was raving, saying things that didn't make sense, which Fensterman said she could have seen, which Fensterman said could have been because of drugs or because of his injuries. The Attorney General's report bolsters these accounts. Quote, Deputy James Rickles told Berg to stay seated and wait for the ambulance to arrive so they could check him out, the report states. Berg did not comply and got up off the ground. Officers tried to use a stun gun, but Berg pulled out the probes, the report states. At one point, officers also used less lethal beanbag rounds. The beanbag struck Berg, and Jones County firefighter Kevin Steele used his taser. But neither seemed to have any effect on Berg and began to run toward a house, the report states. Several officers pursued Berg. Berg then stopped. He turned around and gave a yell, raised his right hand with a knife, and charged the officers. That's when five officers fired their service weapons at Berg. The five officers involved in the shooting were on administrative leave during the investigation by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Last week, the State Department of Public Safety identified the officers. Jones County deputies Tim Miller and James Rickles, Anamosa officers Tyler Hunt and Gabe Humphrey, and Anamosa Sergeant Nick Brokaw. And now let's find another story here. All right. There's one. Oh, this also from the Iowa Today page. Johnson Sheriff looking at satellite office in Solon. County also in discussions with fast-growing Tiffin. This story is by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette. The Johnson County Sheriff's Office is working with the city of Solon to open a satellite office in the former Solon City Hall, as both the Sheriff's Office and the city continue to grow. Mayor Steve Stange, I guess that's S-T-A-N-G-E, Stange, shared the update during a joint meeting between the Solon City Council and the Johnson County Board of Supervisors on Thursday. Stange said the former City Hall is mainly being used to store records. Solon City Council members, he said, brought up the idea of using the building as a sheriff's substation. City staff moved into the current City Hall in May 2014. Quote, since I've been mayor, it'll pop up that people think we need a police department, and that being my previous profession, I know how much that costs and what comes with it, said Stange, who has been mayor since 2014. We really can't get a better coverage than we get from the sheriff's office, he said. The substation would be a place for deputies to meet with the public, take reports, conduct interviews, and follow up on calls for service, Sheriff Brad Kunkel said. Deputies also would have a space to complete reports and paperwork instead of having to drive back to the Iowa City office. The sheriff's office is working on a proposed layout for the satellite station, and no cost estimates are available at this point, Kunkel said. A satellite station, Kunkel said, also would provide more space for the sheriff's office. The office had 50 employees in 1981 when it opened, and just under 100 employees today. A substation, quote, brings a lot of benefits, Stange said. But the other thing it brings is that sign, that presence, that we do have law enforcement presence in our community. Solon grew by 48% in the past 10 years, according to the 2020 census, from 2,037 residents in 2010 to 3,018 residents in 2020. A parallel discussion about a substation is going on with Tiffin, Kunkel said. Tiffin is the fastest growing city in Iowa, growing by 131.7% in the last decade, from 1,947 residents in 2010 to 4,512 residents in 2020. Quote, the city is considering a proposal I offered a while back, Kunkel said in an email to the Gazette. They've also hired a consultant to examine their needs and make a recommendation about law enforcement services in their community. And with that, I will pause for a moment and have another sip of coffee. All right. And now I'll turn to the insight page of the Gazette for first a community letter. We have just one letter today. This is from Anthony Meal. That's spelled M-I-E-L-L of Iowa City. Which matters more, personal freedom or preserving life? With the Republican Party in a nationwide full-court press trying to end abortion, it struck me that there is a relevant argument concerning personal freedom and vaccination to be made here. Republican-led states seem to think they can use their governmental powers however they see fit, hence the wave of draconian abortion laws. But what if Democrat-led states followed suit and used their governmental powers to start mandating that all eligible citizens be vaccinated? Republicans are willing to sacrifice that personal freedom. Republicans are willing to sacrifice that personal freedoms of pregnant women. Republicans are willing to sacrifice the personal freedoms of pregnant women to preserve human life. Democrats could argue that sacrificing the personal freedoms of everybody through enforced vaccination would have the same effect, to preserve human life. Since both arguments involve government control over our bodies and the preservation of life, it begs the question, which matters more, the preservation of human life or personal freedom? If you feel the preservation of human life is paramount, then you should have no objection to allowing government to force you to be vaccinated for the greater good of us all. What's good for the goose, after all, is good for the gander. If, however, you believe in limited government and personal freedom, then it is neither appropriate to allow government to mandate vaccinations nor appropriate to allow them to interfere in the choices of a pregnant woman. It's your call, but it's wholly inappropriate to use government to control someone else's choices without being willing to sacrifice your own. And again, that letter is from Anthony Meal of Iowa City. And now, well, we have this guest column by Sandy Pape. Of Cedar Rapids. September, summer's last hurrah in Iowa. September in Iowa is a smorgasbord of sensory images, a menu prepared with the skill and whimsy of a celebrated chef. We never know what the daily special might be. We just know that it will blend the taste of autumn with the summer cuisine. We're not quite ready to surrender. September's changes are often subtle. Warm, sunny days shorten as cool nights lengthen. Flip-flops and tank tops defy its occasional nip. Air conditioners become an intermittent convenience. Sleeping with open windows means keeping that extra quilt on the edge of the bed, ready to pull up when a chill creeps in. Breath clouds puff out in the cool morning air, and the golden glow of a harvest moon lights up the early evening. September also brings the start of another school year, a time for new shoes and clothes, for school supplies, for meeting new teachers and classmates. Trees preview their autumn reds, yellows, and oranges. Rolls of golden hay dot shorn fields in the countryside. Soon, playful children will tunnel through piles of raked leaves, and many of us will be reminded of years past when trails of smoke swirled up into the air, leaving behind the incense of burning leaves. Butter-drenched sweet corn and juicy red watermelons are less plentiful, and homegrown squash, pumpkins, and zucchini appear on the family table. Hearty soups are served more frequently, and anything flavored with pumpkin spice can be found on market shelves. Apple orchards open to visitors, eager for pies, cobblers, and crisps. Canning supplies are retrieved, and like reminders of grandmother's cellars, preserved fruits and vegetables will soon be stacked in pantries and shared with friends. Garage sale treasure hunting nears its end. Sunscreen and grilling give way to fire pits and hot tubs. Seasonal sporting events overlap. One day it's baseball, hot dogs, and cold beer. The next it's football, chili, and hot chocolate. Ice cream trucks disappear. Pools are drained and closed. Shops already laden with Halloween and Thanksgiving goods make room for Christmas, and TV channels are already previewing holiday movies. Area farmers' markets celebrate the season's harvest. Enticing aromas from food stands mingle, and wines, cheeses, and dips are sampled. Sunflowers, hydrangeas, and gladiolas display their autumn finery, and musicians and performers share their talents with appreciative audiences. Summer's banquet will end with children dreaming of Halloween costumes, while parents make appointments for flu shots and winter car tune-ups. Tennis rackets will be hung in the garage, and knitting needles and warm winter yarns will appear. Yards will become the gathering grounds for squirrels and other animals stocking up their winter food supplies, while birds and monarchs prepare for their migration. September's feast will be all too brief, and though it is summer's last hurrah, it will leave us with the promise of one final pre-winter entree ready to be served, October. And that is a very poetic column by Sandy Pape, who lives in Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, September 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now I'll turn to today's obituaries. Well, first we have the short notices. From Fayette, Cheryl M. Q, that's spelled C-U-E, 68, died Friday, September 17th. Arrangements are with the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home of Olwine. From Fort Atkinson, Vera Newsill, 84, died Thursday, September 16th. Arrangements are with the Schluter Balick Funeral Home of Fort Atkinson. From Maquoketa, Julianne, also known as Julie Streets, 73, died Thursday, September 16th. Arrangements are with the Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. From Marion, Helen Brown, 93, died Thursday, September 16th. Arrangements are with the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids. From Sigourney, Robert E., also known as Bob Weir, 70, died Thursday, September 16th. Arrangements are with the Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Sigourney. And now I'll drop down the page for the longer notices. From Cedar Rapids, Richard, also known as Rick Talcott, passed away suddenly on Sunday, September 12th. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, September 21st at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A visitation will be held on Monday, September 20th at Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom from 4 to 7 p.m. Burial will be in the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Robert C. Bunge, that's spelled B-U-N-G-E, 86, of Loudon, passed away in the early morning hours of Friday, September 17th. Funeral services will be held at Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudon on Wednesday, September 22nd at 10:30 a.m. with the Reverend Daniel Redhage officiating. Visitation will be held on Tuesday, September 21st, also at Trinity from 4 to 7 p.m. Burial will be in the Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Terry Allen Hull, 72, of Cedar Rapids, died on Monday, September 13th. At his request, no service will be held. There will be a celebration of life at the small pavilion at the Shaver Road entrance of Cedar Lake from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, September 22nd. From Dyersville, Norma Rose Bildstein, 87, of Dyersville, passed away Thursday, September 16th at the Anamosa Care Center. Visitation will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. on Monday, September 20th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue from 8:45 to 9:45 a.m. at the funeral home before the funeral mass. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, September 21st at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Tyler Raymond will officiate. From Decorah, James, also known as Jim Peter Lage, or Lage, spelled L-A-G-E, 82, of Decorah, passed away on Tuesday, September 14th, at Reed Healthcare Center in Richmond, Indiana. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, September 20th, at Decorah Lutheran Church, with the Reverend Randy Gehring officiating. A private family burial will take place on Tuesday, September 21st, at the Minnesota State Veterans Cemetery in Preston, Minnesota, with full military honors. Visitation will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, September 19th at Felstall Funeral Home in Decorah, and on Monday, beginning at 10 a.m., 1 hour before the service, at the Decorah Lutheran Church. From Iowa City, Thomas Lawrence Stokes passed away on September 9th at his home in Iowa City, surrounded by his loving family. He was 70 years old. A memorial celebration for Tom's life will be held on Friday, September 24th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the First Avenue Club in Iowa City. From Cedar Falls, Gary Lee Withoft, died at the age of 72 on September 13th. Let me read that again so it doesn't sound so halting. Gary Lee Witthoff, 72, died on September 13th. A funeral will be held at Cedar Valley Church in Waterloo at 3520 Ansborough Avenue on Monday, September 20th at 10 a.m. The family requests that masks be worn. There will be no visitation. A private family ceremony will be held at a later date, where the family will scatter Gary's ashes at the Witthoff family farm in Washington. All right. I'm searching for the sports page. Here it is. All right. Well, the leading story on the sports page today has to do with high school football. Edco adjusts to 8-player ball. Vikings are coming off undefeated regular season in 11-player game, and the story is by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. When it comes down to it, the game is the game. The Edgewood-Colesburg Vikings are playing 8-player football now instead of the normal 11-player variety. No big deal to most of them. Quote, "We kind of knew it was coming," Edco's Jack Wiska said. "We knew our numbers were getting lower, but we didn't exactly know when it would happen. It could have been 2 years ago. We knew it could be 2 years in the future. Some kids didn't really care. Football is football to them. Some kids didn't really like the idea, so we've had a few kids that didn't go out. But for the most part, I guess people took it and have made the most of it. Because its enrollment in 9th through 11th grades dipped below the threshold of 120 students, Edco could go to the 8-player game. Pardon the delay here. We'll find the rest of the story. Okay. Let me read that last sentence one more time. Because its enrollment in 9th through 11th grades dipped below the threshold 120 students, Edco could go to the 8-player game this cycle, which is what it did. This has been no ordinary 11-player program recently, as the Vikings went 8-1 last season, going through the regular season unbeaten, 7-3 in 2019 and 10-2 in 2018. That latter team made it to the Class A state playoff semifinals. But Coach James Rochford said it was an easy decision to drop. There are only 22 kids on the 2021 roster, and 10 of those are seniors. Quote, "We're fortunate to make this transition when we've got a lot of pretty talented seniors with a lot of experience," he said. "In the future, it's not going to be as flush with talent as we've had the last 5 years. I caught a lot of flack, not a lot of straight derogatory comments, but flack from the community about, really, we're playing 8-man? It's a step down, this and that. Then it was some opposing coaches. You guys are really going to 8-man? But seriously, we don't have the numbers. That's just a fact." Rochford and his staff went to a coach's clinic in southeast Iowa last spring to get tips on coaching the 8-player game. He said the clinic taught them what they didn't want to do as far as schemes and things as much as what they did. Meeting over the summer in Rochford's basement solidified a literal plan of attack. Quote, I asked coaches before to watch a lot of film, draw up some plays they liked and some sets they liked, he said. We went with our sets first and probably came up with half a dozen. Then it was like, quote, I like this play, I like this play. It was kind of like throwing a mud, it was kind of like throwing mud at the wall, trying to get a big scope on things, then taking away some things. EDCO lost its inaugural 8-player game to Turkey Valley 14-0, though that game was called after one quarter because of bad weather. The last 2 weeks have seen the Vikings beat Springville 72-28 and Central City 54-6. EDCO played last night at Alcater Central 2-1. At first it was a little difficult, but eventually when we started figuring things out and started clicking as a team, it became pretty easy, junior quarterback safety Cale Funk said. I think communication has been the biggest adjustment. It's a lot more important. Everybody has got to be able to do their job. In 8-man, if one person doesn't do their job, it could lead to a touchdown or a big play. Whereas in 11-man, there might be someone there who helps you out. Funk leads EDCO in passing and rushing and has accounted for 9 of the team's 15 touchdowns. Quote, I think things are going pretty good, actually, said Wiskus, a senior receiver defensive end. We kind of kept the same scheme game plan-wise. It's just different having 3 less players on the field, obviously. We've worked a lot on leverage, keeping inside and outside leverage, so that way we can make the tackles. You have to be more disciplined. And that is a story about 8-player ball. And now I'll take another sip of coffee and look for the next story. Well, the next story is the Dear Abby column on the back page of the Gazette. Couple has difficulty getting through to each other. Dear Abby, I love my wife very much, but we are unfortunately having a communication interpretation issue. She is inquisitive and asks a lot of questions. I become defensive when I'm questioned. Sometimes I feel it shows a lack of confidence or trust in me. My wife says I'm being too sensitive. There are times when I infer a negative tone, where there is none, and others when I believe my perception is spot on. Sometimes I suspect she's unwilling to accept my answer that does not match her own thinking. My wife seems unable to use alternative phrasing that is less likely to trigger a defensive response. When I try to explain my feelings, it only makes things worse. When I choose to be more assertive, it results in more escalation. I am blessed with a spouse who is independent, strong-minded, and outspoken. How can I develop a thicker skin so I won't feel like I'm second-guessed at every turn? When should I speak up? And this letter is signed Misunderstood in Texas. Dear Misunderstood, now would be a good time to speak up. When you do, tell your wife, the educator, that you feel second-guessed at every turn, and it's time to enlist the help of a licensed marriage and family therapist so you too can improve your communication skills. If she's willing, it could be helpful for your marriage. If she isn't, then go without her to help you figure out whether you really are too sensitive. And that is the Dear Abby column for today. And now let's see what else we have here. All right, here's a column on the Living Page, not a column, but an article on the Living Page of the Gazette. This appears under the title, Rolling Out the Welcome Mat, Art Spreads Welcoming Message to Immigrants. And this story is by Elijah Decius of the Gazette. Cedar Rapids is spreading its wings with temporary art installations designed to reinforce a welcoming, inclusive atmosphere to immigrants and diverse populations that call the City of Five Seasons home. With input from Catherine McCauley, from the Catherine McCauley Center, the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, and residents of diverse backgrounds, the seven sets of wings, each 7 feet wide and 4 feet tall, feature Czech, Lebanese, Indian, Latino, and African themes. Quote, wings are a symbol of hope and freedom, and in this case, we see them as a symbol of inclusion, said Quinn Pettifer, co-chair of the Inclusive ICR Coalition. We welcome people of different backgrounds to Cedar Rapids with open arms and welcoming wings. The wings are the first time Cedar Rapids has incorporated a visual and social public element into the National Welcoming Week it has participated in since 2018. The wings can be seen on display at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, Cedar Rapids Public Library, and National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library through September 17th. On September 18th, the wings will be on display at the Cedar Rapids Downtown Farmers Market. In addition to the new gesture, Welcoming Week in Cedar Rapids has incorporated annual celebrations at Festival Latino, Brewnost, and Asian Fest. The Gazette is a media sponsor of Welcoming Week 2021, and Pettifer is also manager of brand initiatives at the Gazette. But behind the fun, educational pieces of art are a serious economic endeavor, said Jamie Toledo, Economic Development Relationship Manager for the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance. She said highlighting open arms to diversity and inclusion is part of a three-pronged plan to position the city for a bright future. Quote, it's a business imperative to have a community that's inclusive because of how demographics are moving. It's no longer just a social conversation, said Toledo. It's not a nice to have, it's a need to have. With a broad swath of immigrants at every educational level who have called Cedar Rapids home for years, it's important to not only remember the diversity among us, but to celebrate it. Census figures show that immigration will only become a bigger cornerstone of economic success with time, she said. Quote, the immigration population is the one that is growing. Some of our other population numbers are either stagnant or growing backward, Toledo said. The top concern is workforce, workforce, workforce. But more than filling positions across existing companies, the numbers show that immigrants are more likely to be entrepreneurs. Data cited by the Economic Alliance shows that immigrants are 45% more likely to be entrepreneurs than U.S.-born residents. And though they only make up 4.4% of the population, they represent over 15% of workers in science, technology, math, and engineering. Quote, inclusive communities are more attractive to international companies looking to expand their businesses here, said Doug Newman, executive director of the Economic Alliance. After wrapping up the organization of Festival Latino's 10th year in Cedar Rapids, organizer Monica Vallejo said Cedar Rapids has made progress over the last decade. Quote, we Latinos are feeling inclusion. We're feeling like the city has recognized our efforts, our work, Vallejo said. The mayor's proclamation recognizing Festival Latino in recent years has helped the festival's impact as its growth from Green Square to McGrath Amphitheater. This is the first year that Festival Latino and Asian Fest have been recognized as part of Welcoming Week. Quote, Festival Latino is a big thing, not only for Latinos. You see a lot of different colors, she said. It's exciting to see how the new generations want to be involved. We want them to be proud of where they come from. Sites like the one she saw this year remind her of the festival's importance. A Mexican father, Ecuadorian mother, and their two American-born children taking family photos, each with a different flag in hand. Quote, how proud we can be to see this family, said Vallejo, who also serves as president of the local League of United Latin American Citizens Council. Quote, when you see families come take a picture with the flags, we're so emotional. Scenes like these, she said, are a glimpse of the future, one already reflected to varying degrees in Cedar Rapids schools, restaurants, and companies. Quote, people feel like these events bring them together. That's part of living in this space, said Bhumika Nayak, an organizer of Asian Fest, who has been with the event since its inception 8 years ago. Building on a sense of inclusion, Nayak said, Building on a sense of inclusion, Nayak said, organizers hope the festival will help people like where they live. And with that, I will have to stop because we've run out of time. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, September 18th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.